Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. Okay, so let's get started. First of all, thank you and welcome everybody to our presentation today. We're obviously going to be talking about a lot of things having to do with coming back to work, the realities of reopening. I'm going to let Peter take it from here while I do a couple technical things on the side. Go ahead, Peter.
Good morning, everybody. I'm glad we're all here. You know, these are just, you know, exceptional times, to say the least, on so many different fronts. And I don't think, you know, any of us saw the world we would be living in for the last 3 months. And, you know, I think I commented on some of the notes I sent out to folks signing up that what at least my experience has been over the last 3 months is that there's not a lack of information. There's just an abundance of information, almost an overwhelming amount of information. And it's really sifting through and finding, you know, what is truly important, and a lot of it is important, but what's most pertinent and relevant to the world we're speaking to this morning of employers and employees. Dave's going to pose some questions this morning. We found that sort of Q&A approach, we've done a number of webinars now, is often the best approach. But so I should introduce Hannah. Hannah is a colleague of mine, works at Brannon Isaacson. She had the good fortune of starting with us in January and within a couple of months finding herself working remotely like the rest of us, and is joining us today. And she is the backbone of providing much of the information that we've been putting out to folks. Dave, do you want me to pause there?
We're fine. We're back. And
are you back?
We're back.
Have I filled in so that you've been able to
You've done very well. And we have a ton of questions that came in from all of you. We're going to go through them. I'll say rapid fire, but that's almost impossible for Peter, but we're going to give him his best shot today. We're going to be doing some real good questions. So we're going to do that today. Okay? So Peter, are you ready to get started?
I'm ready and willing and able.
Okay. First question, should we ask employees to sign waivers before returning to work so that we are not potentially sued or any other particular area?
All right. Well, so a waiver would be, you know, that piece of paper you give to somebody and saying, you're not going to sue me. You're coming back to work. You're coming back to work voluntarily. You're not going to sue me. Dave, I'll give a simple answer. No, don't do it. If you want me to expand, I will, but don't do a waiver. Basic reasons is I don't think it's effective. I think it's a very bad message to be sending to employees. I haven't advised any client. I wouldn't advise the client to have an employee sign a waiver. I wouldn't, in fact, advise a retail business, by way of example, to ask customers that before they come in the store that they should sign a waiver either. I personally don't think that would be a good idea.
Okay, great. How many feet apart do people need to be in the workplace? In other words, we know it says 6 feet. If it can't be 6 feet, and maybe you have an open office design, do you have to put up plexiglass, or what is the recommendations? And then, of course, for areas like dining or kitchen areas, how do you handle that for employees? And what is your recommendation from a legal perspective?
Well, I'm going to be careful on this one, because I think one thing for everyone to take away is all your circumstances are going to be individual, and you're going to want to, whatever business you're in, whatever operation you're in, you're going to want to look, and this is the most basic an important advice, I think, from planning for reentry, and I know many of you have done this already. You're going to go to the Department of Economic and Commercial Development, the DECD, an agency of the state, and you're going to look for your checklist. And if you're lucky, your checklist has come up. If you're less fortunate, it hasn't been provided yet because you're not allowed to open. But if it's come up, the best measures you can take is to go through that checklist and ensure that you are doing your best, you're exercising good faith to fulfill the requirements of that checklist. And that checklist will address plainly the issues of of social distancing. And as we've all become, you know, aware of both that term and the norm that 6 feet has been sort of the scientifically established standard. And in fact, as I said right at the beginning, there's this ongoing torrent of information that came out. One really important thing for people to realize, maybe it got lost on Friday, the 29th, just before the big June 1st date, another executive order came out from the governor. And if I am looking around during the webinar, it's because fortunately you can't see the amount of paper that I have on my desk in front of me. And I've got one pile for executive orders, one pile for CDC, one pile for you name it, and it's sort of illustrative of the different issues. But Executive Order 55, I think Hannah just very recently did an alert on this one. And this has some very clear direction. And I'll pause for a second because, Dave, I think one of the difficulties people face is, what's a recommendation? What's a guidance? And what is law?
That's a big question that comes up a lot.
Yeah. So if you read a lot of the, for instance, the federal guidance from the US CDC, a lot of it is couched in terms as it is guidelines rather than having the force of law. Law is this, you know, again, high level 101. Law is through either statute or through the adoption of regulation, or in this highly unusual circumstance, this chief executive here of our state, Janet Mills, passing these executive orders. The last one was Executive Order 55 that came out, as I said, on Friday. And I highlighted this morning when I was looking at it, it said, any business, this is right in the executive order, any business authorized now to be open shall, not may or should, shall comply with the pertinent COVID-19 prevention checklist or other state of Maine guidelines. So the law here in Maine is saying you shall comply with that COVID-19 checklist. So almost by incorporation, those COVID-19 checklists, in essence, are the law of the state of Maine, in my opinion. And then these sometimes aren't crafted as carefully as us lawyers would like, or other state of Maine guidance, which seems to me incredibly broad. But I think, you know, your starting point are these prevention checklists that are available, as I said, on the state website. Many of you will have looked at them, pored over them. Monitor them carefully as well, because they also change.
No, that was good. Let's get into cloth face coverings, obviously face masks and so forth. You know, you mentioned it a little bit in your initial conversations about what is acceptable, what has been acceptable. We got a message on the chat, and it's a question that we hear quite a bit. Do employers have to become the mask police, right? What is our requirement? What is our mandate? And I'm sure it's going to be, it depends.
Well, again, piecing together these different executive orders, our governor has, trying to make this as straightforward as possible, has said, if you're going to be open for business and either you're going to be in a place where your employees are interacting with the public or where social distancing is not practical, which in most businesses, there will be places where that is not practical, then a cloth face covering, use that phrase carefully because that's different from a face mask, should be worn, with the exception that if there are circumstances, specifically medical circumstances, where it would not be medically appropriate or safe for that person to wear a face mask, cloth face covering, then there would be an exception. In the context of employment and your employees, the executive order says that you may follow the normal state and federal disability laws in seeking medical information. You don't have to seek medical information, but if an employee said, I want an exception, you could, if you wanted to, say, provide a note from your provider and we will grant the exception. I'm sure many are not going to that step and taking the employee at face value. If the employee says, I don't believe in it, I think that violates my constitutional rights, the employer is certainly within their rights to say, I respect your views. However, our requirements here in this workplace, consistent with Maine law, is that we will not make an exception on that basis. With respect to customers, you cannot request information that would support a medical exception. You would have to take somebody on face value. I think an employer has a responsibility from a safety point of view, compliance with the governor's orders, compliance with safety recommendations from US CDC and the CDC here in Maine, to enforce compliance with that cloth face covering requirement. One of my partners sent around this, what I thought was an exceptional article from the New Yorker, one of the best articles I've read on this subject, by a doctor in Boston. And he was really reflecting on what they have done for the 75,000 employees working in their hospital system in Boston. And he really did distill what he saw as their key strategies for safety down to four elements. And one of those four elements, I think not surprisingly, was the consistent implementation of cloth-based coverings. We're going to pretty much all over our office this very simple four-point poster that emphasizes these four critical matters. That's not required by any rule, regulation, but something we thought would be one of the ways to convey to our employees, you know, the importance of what we see of these four critical issues.
Peter, the question came up that if you do allow somebody not to wear a mask for whatever reason, are you putting others at risk, and what's the risk to the organization? Now, certainly understand that there's some medical reason or so forth, but even then, what is the risk to the organization?
Yes. So if somebody requests an exception and says, you know, they come to HR and say, I suffer from asthma, and you know, my doctor has told me that any obstruction to my breathing will create more problems, you know, I'm completely supportive and understand of that. I think the sort of the interactive ADA dialogue that we all know well would say, well, let's first talk about, do you really need to be in work? And is this something where we can support you doing telework? That would be a potential reasonable accommodation. I recognize many of our clients that just don't have that ability to do it. So we need you to work. Is there a place that you could work on a temporary basis where you would have less exposure to other people? Can we structure it, because you're not going to be wearing a cloth face covering, in a manner where we really minimize your interactions with other people? Are you not going to meet with anybody when you're back in the office? You're going to do everything through a video conference. So, you know, I know that takes time, but I think you get down that type of road. Of course, the issue we faced already, and it's one that's just more obvious, is, well, why does that person not get to wear a covering and you're making me? I told you I don't believe in them. I don't think it's right that you can impinge on my liberty by making me wear one. And I'm not going to say clearly that Dave has a medical condition, because then I'm violating Dave's confidentiality under the ADA. And I'm going to have to walk that line and say, we have a policy, and hopefully, well, ideally we do have a policy on that. And the policy will say that exceptions will be made, you know, based on individual circumstances. And that's the way I'm going to have to answer the question that how come Dave doesn't get to wear one?
Hey, Peter, is it appropriate for the organization, or is it necessary, I guess, I'm trying to rephrase the question slightly, because you've answered part of the question. Is it appropriate for them to have a handbook change itself to add this policy to it? Does there have to be a formal policy for face masks or things like that? Or can it just be guidance or postings and stuff?
Yeah, I think it depends on you know, the workplace and how you approach handbook changes. In my experience with the larger the organization, you have a committee, and the committee reviews it. We're moving at warp speed on many things. Like, we all went out and worked remotely when usually we'd study that for 12 months before we did it, and we did it over a weekend. I think you put together a pretty simple internal memo that serves as your current policy on cloth face coverings. It's high level. It's not complex. It reflects what we've discussed. It reflects what are the requirements of the governor's executive orders. And it allows for exceptions on the basis that we've discussed.
Is there any legal requirement for an employer to pay for the masks if they're required?
Yes, if you are requiring your employees to wear that type of equipment, PPE, essentially, then you should provide that equipment.
Just a couple quick last questions on this, and then we'll move on to the next topic. Question came up, do face shields count as a substitute for cloth masks? My understanding is it does, but I'm just clarifying.
Well, if I'm going to follow at least what the executive orders have said, so the governor in her two key executive orders on this has explicitly talked about cloth face coverings, not face shields. So I'm going to say that right now, legally, they have been considered to be different. And you may, in fact, see in some of the more specific COVID-19 checklists, reference to face shields. If there is reference to face shields, then I think that is an adequate substitute. But in the absence of that, I would be advising people to first and foremost follow the cloth face coverings that certainly is specified by the governor for anybody here in the state of Maine.
And the employers can mandate that vendors or customers or others that enter into the office or environment be required to wear them, correct?
Yes.
Perfect. Moving on to temperatures. Wow, that's the best answer everybody gave here. Peter, thank you. Next, having to do with taking temperatures for employees, visitors, and vendors. Talk a little bit about that, because obviously there's a lot of talk about how to do it properly or how to record that information, who should do it. Great questions.
Yeah, it's been made clear now by the federal government, the EEOC, in guidance they've issued that employers during this pandemic are legally entitled to take the temperatures of employees, which is a medical test, which under normal circumstances would be illegal under the ADA. So we all know now that we can do it. Just the fact that we can do it doesn't necessarily mean we should do it. I think this is a very individual circumstance, and I think it's one that employers should be informed by medical expertise, not by legal expertise. I don't want to be pretending that I have that expertise to advise whether or not that is an appropriate safety measure to take. Make your own decision on that, and if you have the ability to consult with a medical expert, there'd be no better person to ask, particularly someone with an occupational health expertise. Is this something that we should be doing for our facility? The information that you gather remains confidential. That has not been waived by EEOC guidance. So the temperature checks that you take are confidential.
If you are collecting that information and somebody is taking that temperature check, obviously that information needs to be locked under lock and key and protected. What is a simple answer to keep doing this in an effective way?
Well, I got asked before, do you have to then break down all of that temperature information and file it separately? My answer would be no. Medical information, we all know, should not be kept with personnel information, should be kept separate from a personnel file.
We're going to talk about recall, reluctance to go to work, and layoffs. So we're a business, we can reopen now, provided that we can safely social distance employees. May we ask our employees to come back to the office, and can we mandate that?
The governor is still saying that all employees should continue to work remotely to the extent it's practical and feasible. So the fact that you are a business either that did not have to close because it was an essential operation, or you are a business that could open either in May or June to date, does not mean, and I don't think many people are doing this, that you then say, okay, we're open, it's time for everybody to come back. You should evaluate and communicate with all of your employees to determine whether or not the remote work that they have been doing remains practical and feasible. That comes right out of the very latest governor's executive order, which is somewhere in this pile of paper on my desk that I'm not putting my hand on right away. But That should be your first measure. Dave, does that answer that initial question?
I guess the question then goes, if they have to come back and they don't want to come back, how do we deal with a situation where, for example, they are either honestly afraid or in other ways, they just simply want to be on unemployment for a longer period of time, maybe because of the additional $600 pay. This is things that employers are really dealing with. How do we handle that?
Yeah, they are dealing with it. And I speak to many, many clients each week, each day, and it ranges from I'll acknowledge many employees who are out there who are vulnerable, who are scared about coming back to work for a whole variety of reasons. And then we have situations where I've got plainly many clients who have employees who it will be financially disadvantageous to come back to work right now, at least until July 25th, when the $600 federal unemployment supplement is scheduled to expire, although maybe that will be extended, who knows. And my advice is you should have a conversation with each of those people, but find out their circumstance, find out, you know, what is keeping them home. If somebody says, you know, it's a sweeter deal for me, then plainly you could take the position, I'm sorry, but that's not a reasonable or viable position. And unemployment, we can get to that in a minute. The state has given some guidance on unemployment in that type of situation. What I suggest is that you tell your employees that we have a variety of different leaves. And then you're going to say one of the leaves that we have, assuming you have less than 500 employees, is a new federal leave that's in effect now until the end of December. And you may apply, you know, this is the leave. Here's the information on the leave. Here's the poster on the leave. Where I'm getting at is you can inform employees that, in fact, they need to be on what I would call a protected leave of absence. In non-pandemic circumstances, we usually have not allowed employees simply to self-declare that they're not coming to work. We've asked them to get approved for a leave of absence, a medical leave of absence, a personal different leaves. And I think you can sit down with an employee and say, here's our menu of leaves. Let's see which one may apply to you. And if one does apply, make it clear to them that in order for their employment to continue to be protected, because you otherwise would need them back, they would need an approved leave. And if that employee still says, no thanks, I've done the math, I'm not going to apply for that, I think you can get to the position to say, then that's your choice, I respect your choice, and your choice has been to not apply for a leave. In that event, you know, we're going to end your employment by X date, by today, by tomorrow. That is something you have to be strategic, thoughtful, fair about, but it is an issue that more of my clients are facing, and helping them walk down that path. Because there's instances where plainly, if they don't have the labor, they don't have the employees back, then a business that's already vulnerable and shaky is really going to be suffering.
We have a couple of questions that came in on the chat, and I'll give them to you now. Is an extended leave a reasonable accommodation related to possible exposure to COVID for a high-risk individual that relates to worker who cannot work remotely, i.e. professional driver, for example?
Yes. One thing to think about, and when I talk about protected leaves, is whether you have it in your handbook or not, medical leave as a reasonable accommodation for a disabled employee is a leave that every employer should consider. I may, in fact, have a chronic health condition that would necessitate an extended leave of absence as a medical/ADA leave in these circumstances. That would be a situation where, very, I think, appropriately and fairly, you'd seek documentation from the healthcare provider. And like any other ADA leave, you're going to evaluate how much leave is reasonable. You know, I say that and realize that's one of the toughest questions in employment law and HR is when does an extended leave then become an undue hardship?
I'm your host, David Chulo, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, a news talk, WLOB 100.5 FM. We will be right back. In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employee relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsinme.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsNME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsNME.com. That's JobsNME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAKorea.com and Verrill-Law.com.
So, Peter, if somebody wants to come back to work, but the employee is known to have or be at high risk, what's the employer's responsibility for the fact that we know that they're a high-risk individual?
Well, you know, so let's put it into a little bits of buckets. High risk could mean that I'm of a certain age, one that, Dave, you and I are fast approaching, by the way.
Can you stick away from fast and move to slow, please? I'm going to say on that.
I'm sorry, I bundled you in with me.
Thank you so much.
But this is indicative of how, where you look, you can see different things. I've seen 60. And then I was reading some CDC guidance this morning about over 65. I do think on the high risk and age, I suspect I'm preaching to the choir on this with an HR crowd out there. We're going to be very careful to say to people, well, because of your age, you're not coming back to work. We're going to bring back our younger employees. I think we all can hear the age discrimination alarm bells going off there. It seems to me, again, on these high-risk issues, having a dialogue, having a conversation with the employee, the other high-risk, of course, are a long list of medical conditions that make somebody more vulnerable, compromise the immune systems. I think that from an exposure point of view, one of the issues that you may want to address with an employee who's in a high-risk category and they cannot telework, that would always be the first question, is, are they safe to work? Can you provide the necessary measures to make them safe? And I've said this long before the pandemic, I continue to say, we as HR folks, lawyers and professionals should not play doctor, should not play nurse practitioner, should not play nurse. So to the extent you have a question, I think getting information from the employee's provider, like you would in other circumstances, saying, in your opinion, these are the things that we have done in our workplace. You know your patient, our employee, is this person going to be safe? And the fundamental principles of the ADA come into effect. You do not have to, well, have somebody at work. They may go out on leave. If their presence at work would cause a direct threat to either themselves or others that cannot be reduced or minimized to an acceptable level by a reasonable accommodation. So that direct threat ADA language comes into effect there.
Peter, when somebody is traveling from out of state, 14-day quarantine question has come up. Also, you know, might be essential work. How do we deal with that situation, especially if they can't quarantine because they are essential or they're traveling across state lines for New Hampshire, Mass, Vermont? You know, these are great questions. How do we handle that?
Yes, the 14-day quarantine requirement for visitors, travelers to the state, whether they be non-residents traveling into Maine or residents of Maine returning under the governor's executive order, remains a 14-day quarantine period, which would mean that visitors to northern Maine on Friday to inspect the Puritan facility under the governor's orders would have to be quarantined for 14 days, with the exception that the person is performing essential services. That's embedded in the governor's order. So we've addressed this question for a number of clients now who've had an engineer perhaps traveling from New Hampshire or Vermont or Massachusetts who is coming to, let's say, a medical services provider and servicing an important piece of equipment. Then that person under the governor's order is entitled to come to the state and perform those essential services. And that would not be a violation of the quarantine requirement. The executive order is silent on what those persons' other activities could be permissible while they are in the state of Maine. And that's a reflection of the fact that these executive orders are developed quickly and at a high level. And they certainly don't deal with every eventuality.
So for work evaluation process, whereas employers may be asking five questions or other questions when somebody comes back into the work, what's the best way to approach that? And is there anything that we need to do legally for ensuring that that anonymity is kept within the organization?
I think what that question's driving at is one of the important elements. Remember, I had talked about our poster that we would, Hannah had helped put together, sort of our four key points. And one of the four would be screening, and sometimes it's self-screening, but it's, again, what we've all now learned about and been educated about is that there are fundamental questions that may be asked by an employer or an employee may, you know, ask them sometimes through a screening app. I know some employers are using an app and an employee answers a series of questions and, you know, the app may give a green light or a red light depending on the answers. But that is certainly a practice that is one that makes a whole ton of sense. I think the question also got at the confidentiality, and I'm no expert on the apps. I haven't used one myself, but certainly if you're exploring using that type of technology, you're really going to want to understand the issues of storage and how the information gets disseminated, how it gets maintained, sort of devil in the details issues. But on a high level, that degree of screening is one of your key prevention safety measures.
The last question before we move on to a different topic, which is really if somebody has somebody come from out of state and they are visiting them and currently under the guidelines, for example, a family member comes and stays with them. This is the question. And they just came here from out of state. Do we have to quarantine that employee for 14 days? Is that required?
I don't know whether that's addressed in any mandate. I'm not familiar with a mandate that says that. Certainly, it is an option, you know, and an employer who is going to be very careful and prudent may well want to do that if you have that information. And, you know, we can check on that, but I don't think it's required.
The last half of that question by somebody else is, let's say you have a family member that works in a medical facility that deals with COVID cases. What's the responsibility does an employer have to protect the organization if in fact they're aware of that, or do they have no responsibility for that?
I think that each of these situations is going to be very specific and individual to the circumstances. I'd be very careful about not allowing that person to come to work. I think you want that person to observe all of the safety measures that everybody else is observing. If that person themselves comes forward and says, you know, I don't think I should work for this reason, then I would be as supportive as possible of allowing that. But I wouldn't do it unilaterally without them expressing a concern.
Okay, moving on to FFCRA leave. We've talked a lot about leave, but there is a couple of questions. And one has to do with, for example, an employee who needs to be home because summer programs like camps and summer schools are closed. Are these employees eligible for the FFCRA leave?
Anna has just written an article on this, and the article will do a much better job of answering the question in full than I will give. But the answer is yes. Summer programs such as camps and programs where a child would typically be receiving child care during the summer, if those are closed, unavailable because of COVID-19, the U.S. Department of Labor has clarified that that could be a qualifying reason, I think, is it under reason number 5, for either the emergency or the extended family medical leave. The fact that schools themselves are closed only relates to the school year. So a request for leave because there's no school, well, that would be the same in the summer anyway. So that wouldn't necessarily be a basis. One of the things I tell clients on this is you need to understand, and your employees need to understand, what the Families First leave eligibility requirements are, and no better place than that fairly simple poster on it that came out early, and I still use that as a resource. You can always, as an employer, provide more generous leave that goes beyond the scope of Families First. The reason why you want to navigate carefully eligibility is, particularly if you're seeking the tax credits, if you were audited and you've applied it more generously than the law stipulates, then you know the potential is that your tax credits would not be recognized because you've given leave beyond what the federal government said was the eligibility criteria. So those of you who haven't developed forms that could be used by an employee for leave eligibility under either the emergency paid sick leave or the expanded FMLA, to consider having a form. That form not only will help you and the employee walk through what are the eligibility criteria, how they would be documented, what documentation you may require. Of course, if you do it and fill out those forms and the employee provides that information, that will be your very best support for those tax credits if you seek them and give you the substantiation that you properly administered the leave and provided the leave. You know, this is why what we do becomes so tricky, because if you deny leave and you apply the leave law too strictly, you have the obvious exposure. You didn't give me the leave that I was entitled to. If you provide it too generously, obviously no exposure from your employee, but if you premise it on, well, we're going to get the tax credit, you may in fact not if you are over expansive in your leave.
So from an unemployment situation, because I think a lot of questions have come up from unemployment, especially regarding fraudulent unemployment claims. You know, I know Hannah's an expert in this area, and so I thought I'd ask her that question. You're experiencing some unemployment fraudulent claims. What advice would you give our employees whose personal information have been used for those fraudulent claims?
Sure, yeah. Unfortunately, this has been a hot topic the last week or week and a half. There is a mechanism to report issues around identity theft and fraud to the Maine Department of Labor, and I'll post that in the chat in just a few minutes. We've also compiled some resources from the Attorney General's office and the FTC to help employees protect themselves, protect their information. One of those resources is just placing a credit freeze. You can contact Experian and the other major credit reporters to put a credit freeze on your account, and that's one of the mechanisms that can help. But I'll go ahead and post some of those resources as well.
One of the other parts of this is, we had a question that obviously came in. Our employees that remain home and are actively collecting unemployment who have confirmed that their return to work date is unknown at this time, how long do we legally have to keep them on our insurance plans?
The first thing on that would be consider whether or not they are on any form of protected leave. So if they are under an FMLA leave or other form of protected leave, then at a high level, our advice would be you need to maintain them on the group health plan. They're expected to continue to pay their contributions just as if they were working versus being out of work on a leave. If they're not on a leave, then your group health plan is going to dictate their ongoing eligibility for leave. So you should be reviewing your plan, talk to your health insurance broker about, is there a time period where an employee would no longer be eligible for health insurance if they haven't worked for, let's say, 90 days, 60 days, whatever the plan may specify. So you want to check on that. And you would only end the coverage if that was consistent with the directive of the plan, and then provide the requisite COBRA notices. One of the things on this whole question of unemployment, how long someone stays on unemployment, and we didn't really cover it, but the person who says, no, I don't want any of your leaves, I want to stay on unemployment, I am going to stay on unemployment, one of the key questions that they should have is, well, if work is available and you've offered them work and they said, no, I want to stay out, will they continue to get unemployment? And the Department of Labor has on its website, the main Department of Labor, I thought of some helpful FAQs. Many of you will have seen those as well. If you go to the question 14 in the employer section, Department of Labor really lays out the answer there. It's like many of my answers, it's long-winded and it depends and it's qualified and all the rest. But they're essentially saying that if an employee turns down work, what they're going to evaluate is whether or not the offer of work was suitable. And in doing so, they will evaluate whether the employer is taking the necessary steps to minimize the risk of COVID-19 exposure. So we've talked about following the COVID checklists from a liability point of view, from a safety point of view. It'll also, in the end, become an issue about whether or not employees who do not come back to work, who are unwilling to come back to work, what measures you've taken will ultimately determine whether or not their unwillingness to come back to work is a reasonable decision and allows them to continue to collect benefits, or whether, in fact, the benefits will end. This answer as well from DOL says employers should let DOL know if they have recalled employees back to work and if those employees have turned down the work offer. They don't specify how that's done. I'm not someone who receives the unemployment paperwork, but presumably when you receive your paperwork on a claimant, there would be an opportunity to share that information if you have offered them a return to work and they have declined that return to work. The unemployment, as we know, office is inundated, and many of these decisions are going to be made on very little information, I suspect.
I want to ask a question in regards to a follow-up on workers' compensation. If you are telling staff to work from home, what happens if they get hurt at home, moving their desk or something along that lines? Does workers' comp carry over to their house if you are telling staff they have to work there? And where is the line drawn in that area in regards to an employer?
Workers' compensation insurers are anticipating a significant increase in claims from employees working at home. So if I don't set up my workstation properly and I exacerbate or create a back issue, carpal tunnel, those will all be workers' compensation claims. I heard, I think last week, that Memic was offering doing some remote ergonomic advice training setup. And certainly all of that makes very good sense because we're all now working in a different location. And many of us, when we worked in our office, had someone come around and check out all our ergonomics and advise us what to do. So a workplace injury can occur in the home, and I'm sure we're going to see more of that. It will get more complicated when someone says, I tripped over a cable that I've put to hook up my printer to my laptop or whatever it is. I guess I'm showing how ignorant I am, because you don't use cables for any of those things these days. But we're going to have some tricky workers' comp issues. But yes, you can get hurt and have a claim based on being at home. I saw Michael had a question, David, about yes. Expanded FMLA. Oh, thanks, Michael. So expanded FMLA does not apply to employers who have more than 500 employees. In fact, we had a client who went over the 500 threshold just very recently. So it did apply to them for a number of weeks. and then they hit 500 and moving forward, it does not apply to them. That was a pretty unusual circumstance. I think some of us expected that Congress would address that. They went, first of all, to address the less than 500. But as you know, we see that Congress hasn't been able to come together on new legislation right now. And we've got many other, you know, obviously very significant events going on, which means I'm not sure we're going to see a change anytime soon. So no, expanded FMLA does not apply to employers over 500. You may have policies that are comparable that are not required by law, but would provide that type of coverage.
When we're talking about the handbook, we did talk about, obviously, are there any questions regarding that? One of the questions that came in is, it's my understanding that a pandemic statement needs to be included in the employee handbook. Is that true? And do we have any examples that we need to share?
You know, there's no legal requirement. You know, if you have a policy, I have one client who, to their great credit, developed a pandemic policy around the time of the SARS outbreak, so a number of years ago. And I think at the time, some people was, that's great, but why do we need that? And it's proved to be immensely valuable. So I think that the world we live in, it certainly makes sense to be reviewing those types of policies. We have not been doing what we do so regularly as reviewing handbooks because people have had other issues, but I suspect we'll all be looking at a pandemic policy in a handbook. One of the policies that we have just been working on is a remote work or telework or whatever you want to call it policy. We had worked on that for clients pre-pandemic. We've taken what we did pre-pandemic and have developed some policies in that regard. And that gets at some of those, back to some of those issues about injuries at home and reasonable accommodations and who's responsible for equipment and those types of things.
This is an interesting, and we'll probably be wrapping up with these in the next 8 minutes or 10 minutes or so, with what if question. And the question is, what should we do now that we come back to work once we reopen if an employee or a customer reports that they've tested positive for COVID-19 and we were just back at work? Do we have to shut down again? Do we have to quarantine everybody? How do we handle that situation? And also, what are the reporting requirements in regards to either OSHA or other areas?
Yeah, we have to face that reality. And some clients have faced it and addressed it already. Taking that really important question in sort of bite sizes, you know, the first thing I'm advising clients is when, you know, an employee says, oh, my provider has tested positive, or I'm presumed positive based on my symptoms, I haven't had my test yet, is to inform other employees about that positive result. Is there a legal requirement under what we would call a duty to warn? Not specifically, but I think we'd all agree that that's the right and appropriate and safe thing to do. I'm still advising that you should not disclose the name of the employee to coworkers, to others, unless that person has given you permission or consent to do so. But I'm comfortable, and there are lines that people will draw. I think if we put safety first on these issues, that's the best place to be. I'm comfortable with saying we had an employee who tested positive. The employee's last day working in our factory office was yesterday. You may have had exposure to this employee. You're equipping that person with as much information is reasonable so that they can make the necessary judgments about whether they go and see their provider, whether they get tested. Your question, I'm not ignoring it, but should we close down, is going to be specific to the operation. It would seem that, you know, where that person worked will dictate both the extent and nature of your closure, how long your closure would be. There's a lot of very fact-specific decisions to make there. Is it mandated that you close? Not unless the CDC would receive that information and say you need to close. There is new guidance come out from OSHA about reporting, and you don't have to report all positive employees to OSHA. There's a standard, and it would be based upon the standard that the infection, there was a reasonable basis to believe that the infection in fact occurred while the person was working. In the healthcare industry, you know, that is obviously more likely than in some other fields. but that would be an OSHA reportable if it met certain criteria. If the person makes a claim that they thought it was work-related, I'm always of the belief that put your insurer on notice, even if you disagree with that. It's not really your judgment call. That would be one that would work through its system. There is no mandate to contact CDC. The advice I've given actually is you could contact CDC without giving the information and say, is this a value to you? Is this something that you'd benefit from in order to help combat this pandemic?
Yeah, one of the questions that came through on this is, so it is okay to provide information to the CDC for contact tracing?
Yes.
And it's not a violation of an employee's personal information, especially if the name is requested?
Not if the name is requested by the CDC. I don't see that as a violation.
Okay, perfect. Peter, any final words before we go?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with everybody again. I hope it's helpful. I realize that it's unbelievably challenging time and there is an abundance of information. And what we're trying to do is get you information and do so in as sort of practical and common sense manner as possible. And I said to people many, many times, you're never going to achieve perfection. And you're used to, you know, having that compliance role in HR. There are too many competing risks to be able to put your head on the pillow at night and say, I managed all of those. And using good faith, good judgment, and putting safety first are going to be cornerstones, I think, of our success in addressing this. The business reality is unmistakable, true, and one that, you know, we're going to continue to face and wrestle with.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now, your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Hi, I'm Richard Moon from Verrill. This week's Tip of the Week is you should review your current policy on work breaks. Most employers have policies dealing with work breaks, whether they're smoking breaks or statutorily required breaks after a certain number of hours. They also could involve meal breaks and breaks that are paid or unpaid. But the issue will be now, do you allow people to gather? How do you assure that when people go out to a smoke shack, they're not standing too close? Have you decided how you will monitor breaks and assure not so much that they're being held to the correct amount of time, but that you're not exposing employees to unsafe practices in the workplace? There are also state requirements that have to do still with monitoring space between people, and you should be cognizant of them as you review your practices to comply with both state and federal law.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.